Welcome to the Holistic Health Show. I'm Dr. Carl O'Helvey, your host at www.holistichealthshow.com. Our guest today is Dr. Bernie Siegel. Dr. Siegel, who prefers to be called Bernie, not Dr. Siegel, was born in Brooklyn, New York. He attended Colgate University and Cornell University Medical College. He holds membership in two Scholastic Honor Societies, Phi Beta Kappa, and Alpha Omega Alpha, and graduated with honors. His surgical training took place at Yale New Haven Hospital, West Haven Veterans Hospital, and the Children's Hospital of Pittsburgh. He retired from practice as an assistant clinical professor of surgery at Yale of General and Pediatric Surgery in 1989 to speak to patients and their caregivers. In 1978, he originated Exceptional Cancer Patients, a specific form of individual and group therapy utilizing patient drawings, dreams, images, and feelings. Exceptional Cancer Patients is based on Carefrontation, CareFrontation, which is a safe, loving, therapeutic confrontation which utilizes personal lifestyle changes, personal empowerment, and healing of the individual's life. The physical, spiritual, and psychological benefits which followed led to his desire to make everyone aware of his or her healing potential. He realized exceptional behavior is what we are all capable of. Bernie and his wife and co-worker Bobby live in a suburb of New Haven, Connecticut. They have 5 children and 8 grandchildren. Bernie and Bobby have co-authored their children, books, and articles. Their home, with its many children, pets, and interests, resembles a cross between a family art gallery, museum, zoo, and automobile repair shop. It still resembles these things, although the children are trying to improve its appearance in order to avoid embarrassment. In 1986, his first book, Love, Medicine, and Miracles, was published. This event redirected his life. In 1989, Peace, Love, and Healing, and in 1993, How to Live Between Office Visits followed. He is currently working on other books with the goal of humanizing medical education and medical care, as well as empowering patients and teaching survival behavior to enhance immune system competency. Bernie's realization that we all need help dealing with difficulties of life, not just the physical ones, led to Bernie's writing his fourth book in 1998, Prescription for Living. It helps people to become aware of the eternal truths and wisdom of the sages through Bernie's stories and insights, rather than wait for a personal disaster. He wants to help people fix their lives before they are broken, and thus not to have to become strong at the broken places. Published in 2003 are Help Me to Heal, to empower patients and their caregivers, and 365 Prescriptions for the Soul. In 2004, a children's book about how difficulties can become blessings, Smudge Bunny. In 2005, 101 Exercises for the Soul. And out in the fall of 2006, a Prescriptions for Parenting book, Love Magic and Mud Pies. Published in 2008, Buddy's Candle, for children of all ages, related to dealing with the loss of a loved one, be it a pet or parent. And to be published in 2009, Faith, Hope, and Healing, with survivor stories and his reflections about what they teach us. His website is www.berniesiegelmd.com. That is www.berniesiegelmd.com. Woody Allen once said, if I had one wish, it would be to be someone else. Bernie's wish was to be a few inches taller. His work has been such a growth experience that he is now a few inches taller. His prediction is that in the next decade, the role of consciousness, spirituality, non-local healing, body memory, and heart energy will all be explored as scientific subjects. For many, Bernie needs no introduction. He has touched many lives all over our planet. In 1978, he began talking about patient empowerment and the choices to live fully and die in peace. As a physician who has cared for and counseled innumerable people whose mortality has been threatened by an illness, Bernie embraces a philosophy of life and dying that stands at the forefront of the medical ethics and spiritual issues our society grapples with today. He continues to assist in the breaking of new ground in the field of healing and personally struggling to live the message of kindness and love. Welcome to the Holistic Health Show, Bernie. It's good to have you here with me today.
My pleasure, Carl.
Bernie, you were one of the early physicians using a holistic mind, body, spirit, humanistic approach in medicine. How did this come about?
Well, I think it came about for several reasons. One, I became a doctor because I wanted to help people. And I think that's an issue that isn't really looked at well enough in medical school. You know, you might say the healthy and unhealthy reasons why you go into medicine. So you go into medicine wanting to help people, and then you realize there's an awful lot of things you can't fix and cure. And you begin to ask a lot of questions, spiritual as well as medical. I attended a workshop one day. It was run by Carl Simonton that had to do with helping cancer patients. And when I saw it advertised, I thought, hey, this is for doctors. And I went there and was blown away. There were about 125 people. Only three of them were doctors, and the other two were psychotherapists, basically. But being exposed to your patients there is what changed me, because we weren't in an office setting. You know, we were sitting next to each other.
There's
an exact quote from one of my patients with breast cancer. She said, "You're a nice guy. I feel better when I'm in the office with you, but I can't take you home with me. So I need to know how to live between office visits." And that literally led to the total change in my life and practice, because I thought, you know, if I can help people live, then I don't have to feel like I'm failing.
Right.
You know, when I can't cure something, at least I'm helping them live with it. And that's when, again, my next awakening was sending 100 letters to our patients from our office. And I say that because you're getting a letter from your doctor, you know, not a stranger.
Right.
Saying, come to a group. I want to help you to live a longer, better life. And I thought hundreds and hundreds of people were going to show up because I wasn't excluding friends and relatives. You know, it's just to say you can't bring anybody you want to bring with you. And I really was in a panic for a few weeks, wondering, what are you going to do with 300 people?
Right.
And less than a dozen women showed up. And I thought, wow, I obviously don't know the people I'm caring for if their response to let me help you live a longer, better life is no thanks. I have other things I need to do, or I won't do it right, or what if I don't live longer? You know, am I a failure? But what I learned underlying it all was that if you help people live, you also had some wonderful things happen in a physical sense, you know, what messages their body then received. And so the way I put it is they didn't die when they were supposed to, you know. I mean, some literally had diseases disappear that was just called incurable, and others, you know, instead of dying in 2 months, could live for 5 years. Now, let me add one more thing, because, see, when you say, you know, you're one of the first to this and that, I think part of why I stirred up the world is that I am a surgeon. I'm a practicing doctor. You know, so it was harder for other doctors to poo-poo what I was doing.
Right.
They could get mad at me and be on all the famous talk shows yelling at me, but it really confronted them. But the other was, what I found was, I wasn't the first. That if you looked into the psychological and psychiatric literature, these things were written about all the time.
Oh.
You see, but they didn't get into what I call the medical literature. You don't find a psychiatrist article in an oncology journal.
Right.
But Carl Menninger, years ago, I got to know him, read many of his books, Man Against Himself, Love Against Hate, and I noticed how many cases, The Will to Live by Hutchinecker. I mean, all these books were popping up, Larry Lachon, You Can Fight for Your Life, and I thought, wow, look at all this. And Menninger said to me that he was about to write a book called 12 Hopeless Cases. And these were 12 people, all declared hopeless, who were perfectly well and healthy today. And he said, but I'm not writing it because you just wrote it. And that was when I sent him a copy of Love, Medicine, and Miracles. And also, when I sent my articles to medical journals, they came back saying, it's interesting, but it's not appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
And when you sent them to her as appropriate, it came back again, saying it's appropriate, but it's not interesting. You know, we know this. And I thought, ugh. The thing I liked was they didn't say that you're a little bit right and you got the, you know, but a little bit wrong. They said, yes, we know this. It's consistent. That helped affirm that what I thought I had discovered was true mm-hmm. and was known. And that's from the use of dreams and drawings and a lot of Jungian things that I learned from Elizabeth Kubler-Ross that, again, I was really in a sense obsessed that why didn't somebody tell me about this when I was in medical school, you know, and make it the mind-body approach something that I could believe in and understand.
Mm-hmm.
Because I hear a lot of doctors say, I can't accept that. I said, wait a minute, I'm telling you a true story about a patient. I can't accept it. I said, if you can't explain it or understand it, okay, I agree with you.
Right.
You know, it's like saying I know how the universe is formed, but we're still here living it, even if we have questions, you know, that astronomers and quantum physicists can't answer. Mm-hmm. But you see, they're not afraid of the unknown.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when you go to medical school, the unknown isn't brought up.
Right.
You know, the wisdom of the body and the things that we're just beginning to learn about in terms of genetics and everything else,
that
to me is a wonderful mystery about creation.
Now, you use the drawings and the dreams and all with your cancer patients, and you've been doing this since the 70s.
Right.
Can you tell us a little bit about your exceptional cancer patient program?
Yeah, what I started, as I said, when we sent out that letter, we began to meet for a couple of hours every week. And really, I have to say, I learned from the patient because I was in a panic. I'm not a therapist. What are you going to do with them? Oh, and a lot of oncologists yelled at me and said, you'll make them worse because you don't know what you're doing. But I brought, you know, my life there, too. And I realized that you're not here to tell them what to do. Listen. And when I listened, the way I put it now is the native taught the tourist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they began to share the themes that worked. And you began to hear these common themes. And they're in myths, fairy tales, as well as various religions and therapy organizations. It's, you know, how do you change your life? How do you rebirth yourself? A lot of ways of saying it. But by sitting and listening, we helped each other know ourselves and what we needed to do in our life. And I haven't stopped doing this for 30 years. And I can tell you that it's therapy for me, too. When I leave that room, there's more life in that room full of cancer patients than there is outside. So when I come out, I feel better, and it's easier for me to go on.
Mm-hmm.
But we began to use things like guided imagery. How do you communicate with your body through images? One of the things I asked them to do if they were going to join the group was, yes, to read books. Even before I had written mine, I had a list of books that I'd like them to read. And then I would say, draw a picture of yourself, your disease, your treatment, and your immune system eliminating the disease. They learned to stop using words like kill, because we had one patient, one group member who was a Quaker, and he refused chemotherapy. So the doctor said, I'm going to kill your cancer. And he said, I don't kill anything. So I learned that it had to be very specific and precise for the patient.
Right.
And a word like eliminate could mean you can use God's light to melt a block of ice. Or you can, yeah, have your German shepherds gobbling up, you know, the tumor too. But it was what was felt right for the person. And I'd look at that, and I'd ask things like your home, draw your home and family, draw yourself at work. So we'd have the symbol that we could work with, and it wasn't me telling them what to do or criticizing them. Because, like, one woman drew, her husband's an alcoholic smoker. So the house and the car are red and black because she can't breathe, and he drives while he's drunk, and that you can look at that picture and talk to her about what she's going through and maybe changes that she would want to make in her life with her husband. And that way it would empower. And then even the chemotherapy or radiation or surgery. I mean, the people draw themselves in the operating room, but what they are in is a black box and there isn't anybody there while they're lying on a table. So you could say to the person, maybe you shouldn't have surgery, or you need another surgeon or a different hospital. But you can also change their view of it by saying, let's visualize you going to the hospital, everybody caring for you, having a wonderful procedure, you know, everything going well, and you're comfortable when you wake up, and blah, blah, blah. And then a week or two later, you say, draw me another picture. And it's incredible, the change. You now have all these doctors and nurses around you, the family's there, God's light is shining in the window. I mean, it's just a beautiful picture.
Right.
And we know this from studies now. See, now that people's beliefs have shifted, they've done studies of this type. I mean, one recent one was a simple one. Before a person was going into the operating room, they had two groups. One they went to and said, what would you like to talk about for 15 minutes? Anything on your mind? And the other group, they said, let's spend 15 minutes picturing successful surgery. And the group that did the imagery needed less anesthesia, did less bleeding. You know, the procedure went faster. Mm-hmm. They had less pain. And this is just investing 15 minutes in it.
Wow.
So you can see how you shift the person's beliefs,
right?
And that shifts their chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
And it used to amaze me as a surgeon to do major surgery and have people wake up and say, yeah, I'm a little sore, but I don't need any medication.
Right.
And many of the nurses at the beginning would write, refuses medication.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd say, why don't you write, is not in pain in the chart,
right,
rather than refuses? Because they were thinking the way I was. That,
right.
How could this be, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But they began to realize, yeah, where the person's mind was made an enormous difference. I mean, let me give you one other example.
Mm-hmm.
On a personal level, a radiotherapist called me to say, I thought the machine was broken because this woman had no reaction, no redness of skin, nothing adverse happening. And he thought, gee, maybe my machine is broken. He said, but then I saw your name in the chart, and I realized it's a crazy patient. So he said, I went into her, and I said, how come you don't react to the x-ray? And she said, I'd get out of the way and let it go to my tumor.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he called me to tell me that kind of answer.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that was interesting, too, this is from a total stranger. We're at a medical meeting, and this radiation therapist comes up to me and says, you know, our machine was repaired. We did not know it, but they didn't put the radioactive material back in it.
Oh.
And we didn't discover this till a month later when we are, again, rechecking the machine. And I said, you realize what you're telling me? He said, what do you mean? I said, think for a minute. You are not radiating anybody for 1 month. Don't you think you would have awakened to that after a week or so?
Mm-hmm.
But it's obvious that some people had their tumor shrink. Some people's skin got red. Other side
mm-hmm.
effects. And he said, oh, my God, you're right. You know, it never occurred to him
right.
that the reason they missed it was that everybody thought they were being radiated and so acted that way.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when you begin to realize how powerful the mind is
right.
and why doctors need to be trained to talk to people.
Mm-hmm. Right.
One of our children wrote the word words on a campus. He was doing a project at school. And he wrote words, 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 words. And when he brought it home, I looked at it and I thought, wow, thank you. Words, words, sword, 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 sword. So we can kill a cure with words, and I mean that literally.
Right.
Or with scalpel.
Yeah. Right. What would you say are some of the very important things you learned about healing? About healing from using this approach with cancer patients.
Yeah, I think that it's talking, again, about the body's chemistry as well as doing
mm-hmm.
what's right for you
mm-hmm.
so that when people are making decisions only based on what's going on in their head and statistics, that's, again, where the drawing can help. What I mean by that is I will have people come in and say, I don't want chemotherapy, who do a beautiful drawing of
mm-hmm.
chemotherapy.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are people having chemotherapy can't understand why I'm having all these troubles, and the picture's a horror. And I try to get them to understand that if you're living in conflict, you're going to have trouble.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to know, yes, what's going on in my head, but also what's going on in my heart, my intuitive sense, and combine the two and then make your decision.
Mm-hmm.
Then you go in a unified approach and will do better than somebody who's prescribed chemotherapy but doesn't
right.
want it.
Right.
And their conflict and what happened.
Mm-hmm.
So I always say to people, how does it feel to do this? And another statement I often make is, are you trying not to die or do what's right for you? Because, oh, somebody just sent me an article that was in the Journal of the American Medical Association where a woman has had chemotherapy, her cancer recurs years later, she just doesn't want to go through it again.
Right.
And what does her oncologist say to her? Well, you might as well go home and commit suicide.
Hmm.
You know, who was he to say something like that?
Right.
I mean, if she said, I'd rather die than go through this, okay, why not help her to live then?
Right.
See, or offer other suggestions. I mean, those are things I would do for people. Alternative, complimentary.
Mm-hmm.
Here's something so you don't lose all hope.
Right.
And again, you know, there are people who are given drugs that don't have any beneficial effect in the sense of any proven effect, and yet the people get better because they believe in their treatment.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So you have to work with beliefs and feelings and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
But I keep repeating many times, are you trying not to die or do what's right for you?
Mm-hmm.
Because I've had people in the office that I have to laugh sometimes because they say, I'm eating vegetables to get well, but I hate it. So they prefer, can you operate, give me chemotherapy, you know, because, I mean, one man said, the kids don't eat with us anymore. My wife hates preparing it. And I laughed. I said, yes, you can have other treatments. But it's again, and I have to say, when they draw a picture, the kitchen and the house look horrible because all I have to do, all I'm eating is vegetables, and I don't enjoy it. And that's why I think people have to look at what is your labor pain. See, that's my way of saying it. That if you choose your therapy, you will have fewer complications, just as a woman who's literally in labor and surrounded by support and love has fewer complications and less pain delivering a child than somebody who's going to go in the operating room or have some other treatment. If you're surrounded by love, making your decision, and not something imposed by others, you know, your family says, we don't want you to die. The doctor says, here, you have to do this. That's not your choice.
Mm-hmm.
So it has to be your choice and surround yourself with support, and then it'll make an enormous difference how you respond to it.
Right. Bernie, you developed an immune competence personality test that I thought was interesting. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah. I mean, it came from psychiatrist George Solomon a good number of years ago when AIDS first started. There wasn't much that could be done to treat it. And as a psychiatrist, he said that instead of giving people, you know, 10 pages of personality profiles to predict how they were going to do, he had these simple set of questions. And let me add that this is not something new. Back in the 1940s, psychologist Bruno Klopfer was given personality profiles of 24 cancer patients, and he ticked correctly 20 out of 24 whether they were going to have a rapidly growing or a slow growing tumor.
Mm-hmm.
Two, he said, I can't tell, and two, he was wrong. And my comment is maybe those two change their personality because of the cancer. But you see, here's the guy who 20 out of 24 times tells you what's going to happen from a personality profile.
Mm-hmm.
And George Solomon's questions were very simple. The first was, do I have a sense of meaning in my life and daily activities? And we see this on Monday morning, you know, with heart attacks, suicides, and strokes. Can I ask friends and family for support and favors when I need them? Am I able to express anger appropriately in defense of myself? And that's something I tell people when they go to the hospital. Don't be a nice, submissive patient and have a medical error made and, you know, end up being killed by the wrong treatment. Speak up. And appropriate anger is not you don't care about the other person, but it's talking about how I'm being treated.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I'm called room 422 or breast cancer, hey, that's not me. I want to be treated like a person or referred to by my name. So speak up. As a matter of fact, three women, I said to them, I'm going to an oncology conference. What do you want me to ask for you? I thought they'd all say, cure cancer.
Mm-hmm.
They said, tell the doctor to knock on my door, look me in the eye when he talks to me, and say hello and goodbye.
Oh.
So, yeah, if they don't treat you that way, it's okay to be angry.
Mm-hmm.
One that's really important is, am I able to say no to someone who asks for a favor if I can or don't feel like doing it?
Mm-hmm.
And nurses also have a lot of trouble with that question.
Right, right.
You know, it's like if you're nursing the world, you're saying no to yourself all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So if you don't want to do something, you know, get back to your question of feeling, if it doesn't feel right, say no.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that doesn't mean that you can't do something out of love, but that's a very different choice.
When
you say, yes, I'll change my schedule and I'll do this. Not because you're filled with guilt, but because you want to love and share with the other person. Do I fill, you might say, prescriptions based on my needs or my doctor's, you know, desires and prescriptions? And it really should be on your needs, how you respond to what others tell you. So, again, there's no conflict. It's not somebody else prescribing what you feel is ruining your life, but it's something that you're deciding to go through to, as I say, give birth to yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Do I have enough play in my life? The thing that has always impressed me is when I have no sense of time, I feel perfectly healthy and well.
Mm-hmm.
And I always say to people, find what makes you lose track of time and go do it. It's the healthiest thing you can do. You're in a trance state. And so you can refer to play in that way, you know, doing what you enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that could be, yes. I mean, I've operated on people for hours when I've been in pain, but felt no pain while I was caring for someone else.
Mm-hmm.
You see, so to me, whether I'm painting a portrait or operating on somebody, I'm doing something that's also good for me because I am being creative, sharing my love, and doing things.
Mm-hmm.
One that I find very important is that if I feel depressed for long periods, so I feel hopeless about ever getting over the conditions that caused me to be depressed. And what I learned from a friend of mine one day was that she said to me, how are you feeling? I said, oh, I got a lot of things going on. She said, look, you get upset when you're hungry. I said, no. She said, what do? I get something to eat. She said, right. So ask yourself, if you don't like how you feel, how do I have to nourish myself in my life to make this feeling go away?
Mm-hmm.
And I love that because
right.
I always used to have what I called happy depression.
Mm-hmm.
That if I felt a depression, it was, okay, what do you have to do to make yourself feel happy? You know, how do you change this rather than getting depressed about being depressed,
mm-hmm.
knowing it's not good for your immune system? And I say to people, again, use your feeling to direct your life. So the feeling becomes a blessing in a sense, not a curse, because it's changing you.
Mm-hmm.
And the last was, am I living a role in my life to the detriment of my own needs? And to me, that is, well, you see it more with men. I can't work. What's the point of living?
Right.
And they go home and die. And I've had men say that while their family's sitting in the room with them.
Mm-hmm.
And I point out their children and their wife, and it's like, oh yeah, that's right. That's a good reason. And women will say things like, can't die till you're all married and out of the house. But what happens when the kids leave home?
Mm-hmm.
Say, who are you? So I want people to live an authentic life. And there's nothing wrong with working or being a parent.
Right.
But it's not how you identify yourself and that you have worth. And a lot of this gets back to how you brought up, too, because that's something I began to see, how you were parented and how that affects how you care for yourself. That if
right.
you don't have self-love and self-esteem, then it's really hard to care for yourself, not become addicted to something, and, you know, choose life.
Mm-hmm.
And all you've heard all through your years are, you're a failure, you embarrass us, we didn't want you. It's just awful. Oh, let me add one more while I'm saying that
mm-hmm.
to any listener, that if you have a problem, always say to yourself, how would I describe this problem to other people? And I didn't ask for your diagnosis. I said, what does it feel like to be going through what you're going through? So that could be a headache. It could be a life-threatening illness. But what I find is that the words that pop out of people
mm-hmm.
are always related to their lives. So when somebody said failure, she said, my parents committed suicide when I was a child. I must have been a failure as a child. And when people use words like draining and sucking, you know, they're talking about what's draining their lives and sucking the life out of them.
Mm-hmm.
And then we say, all right, let's get those things straightened out and then derive physical benefits from them. I mean, a headache, you know, can be pressure,
mm-hmm.
a burden. And, yeah, it's been a marriage and a job, and you work on those things and the headaches go away.
Bernie, one thing I wanted to ask, too, and that's about other things that stimulate the immune system, like some of the nutritional herbal immune boosters and also blood purifiers. Do you use those with your cancer patients if they want them?
Well, my first thought when you said the immune system was a study on laughter
mm-hmm.
by the American Psychosomatic Association
mm-hmm.
that showed that cancer patients who laugh live longer.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't that you had to tell them a joke, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm. That,
and I always say this to people, stop and laugh 4 times a day. Watch how you feel. And if you're laughing out loud while there are people around you, watch what happens to the other people. So You know, that's one aspect,
right.
Emotional. The other is, yes, I mean, what I tend to do, I take a lot of supplements of all kinds, too, because I try to live the sermon. But I try to give people resources and organizations that they can call, you know, things that they can read so they can then make appropriate decisions. Because there are so many supplements and herbal products that have anti-cancer effects, as, you know, as well as immune-stimulating. So I'm constantly learning and reading and then referring people to these things.
When I had lung cancer, and we talked about that when I was on your show, I had a very restrictive diet, which was 90% raw fruit and vegetables. Do they still use such a restrictive diet with cancer patients?
No. I would say that as physicians, we're not opened to this as part of our training. And one of the things I often say to people is, you know, when I will recommend certain vitamins or supplements, and they'll say they asked their doctor, and the doctor said, I don't know, so don't do it. And I said, you know, if the answer is I don't know, then go ahead and do it.
Right.
You know, right, but you see, that's the part that bothers me, that a lot of doctors are speaking out of ignorance. I don't know, it might interfere with your treatment. Well, why don't you find out? So if some vitamin interferes with chemotherapy, okay, you can say to a patient, don't take that specific substance. It can interfere. But I think most of the time it's spoken out of a lack of knowledge. You know, how, what it might do to the cancer cell or whatever it is. And that's why I say to people, go get a good source of information.
Right.
Read about it. Talk to people. And I find people like the naturopaths, who are licensed in my state of Connecticut, often have more information and can be more helpful to cancer patients than an MD. Matter of fact, one of our kids is in Europe right now getting some treatment in Switzerland or something. And it's interesting because he said to me there, the MDs also have an ND, in other words, a naturopathic.
Oh, they do?
That it's all part of their training.
Oh.
So when they go into practice, they've got this background of information and can help people. From homeopathy to everything else.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And that's, you know, and again, I would say even if they weren't, you know, even if they limited their practice to certain things, at least I think they would remain open-minded. So if a patient comes in and says, I'm doing this or I want to try this, they don't say, no, no, you know.
Right.
Or I can't
right.
accept that. They can say, all right, fine, go ahead, you know.
Right.
See how it helps you.
Well, I appreciate your being with us today, Bernie, and I look forward to talking with you again in the future.
My pleasure.
My second guest tonight is Padma, who is one of Canada's best-known teachers of meditation and yoga, and who writes and hosts a daily national TV series called Living Yoga with Padma. She has also produced two instructional DVDs on yoga and meditation. Padma studied meditation in the Himalayas of India for 8 years. She mastered Sanskrit texts of philosophy and is authorized to teach meditation and yoga by the director of the International Meditation Institute of India. Her programs unite ancient Eastern wisdom with modern Western living. In Canada, she has been educating yoga teachers, doctors, and corporate clients in the subtle yogic arts of healing of the body and clearing the mind. Padma was director of the Padma Yoga and Meditation Center in Vancouver, BC, and currently leads courses and workshops. She holds a baccalaureate degree in biology from McGill University in Canada. Her website is www.padmameditation.com, and she can be reached at padma@padmameditation.com.
I welcome you to the Holistic Health Show, Padma, and I'm happy to have you here.
Well, thank you very much, Carl.
I'm wanting to take advantage of your expertise about yoga and meditation and ask questions that I think will be of interest to our listeners. I'd like to ask a few questions for our listeners about meditation.
Sure.
What is the essence of meditation?
For me, the essence of meditation is the practice of getting back in contact with your real self, really feeling that you've brought your attention back to your own essential core, and that good feeling of when you're really true to yourself and you know where you're standing and where you're coming from.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the opposite of kind of being lost and scattered and disarrayed and out of balance,
mm-hmm.
and confused, like a lot of us are running around in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Meditation is the opposite, the antidote to all of that. It's bringing yourself back to a still place where you feel your center, your balance, your clarity of mind, and your confidence in yourself.
Mm-hmm. And how can meditation keep us healthy?
Well, meditation can keep us actually physically healthy because it allows us to take some time, firstly, just to check in with what's going on. If you take a few moments just to check in with your body and ask, you know, what's going on here? Is there something I need to be paying attention to? When we just run through the day, often we overlook the early warning signs, the
mm-hmm.
signals that something's going on. So meditation, just as an awareness practice, helps to keep us in touch with our body, what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, just sitting still is really, really healthy. It
right.
feels really good once you find a comfortable position to sit in. The body just loves to be in a still place, but not necessarily asleep.
Mm-hmm.
It's a waking stillness. And somehow that feeling in the body is deeply, deeply soothing and just gives a positive feeling through the whole body, which inspires, the immune system, the hormonal system. Everything just feels safe and good, and your cells respond to that
mm-hmm.
environment of safety. And also mentally, I believe that meditation helps you have more mental health.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of running after our thoughts and kind of getting wound up and confused in them, you have some time just to sit down, kind of clear the blackboard,
mm-hmm.
clear the slate for a while, and get back to a space of just calm and focus and ease in yourself, uncluttered, unbusy. It's a very strong place for the mind to come back to and feel balanced and healthy.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned sleeping. I've found that lately when I meditate, I fall asleep and I usually wake up maybe an hour later.
Mm-hmm.
Is that still effective or not?
Well, there's a practice called Yoga Nidra, which is actually a yogic sleep. And so when you meditate deeply, sometimes you think you go into sleep. But it's actually not the same as deep sleep. It's actually a yogic sleep. So you're not fully asleep. You're just extremely relaxed.
Well, I actually had been using some of the time Kenyan theta that
mm-hmm.
affects it's the waves,
mm-hmm.
his wave series. Are you familiar with them?
Not exactly, no.
They affect the different brain waves.
Mm-hmm.
So possibly it was putting me into a deep, because one of them is for deep relaxation, and one of them is supposed to open the heart chakra.
Mm-hmm.
So perhaps that is why I've been sleeping. And, I mean, thinking
yeah.
I was sleeping.
Thinking you were sleeping, exactly, because what you do is you go into the state which is so relaxed that even your mind goes into a state which is quiet and still in it beyond thinking.
Oh.
So because you're not thinking, you think you've gone to sleep.
Oh.
But you might just be in this deep, quiet space. You
mm-hmm.
know, someone were to say, Carl, you'd probably open your eyes and be right there.
Right.
So your alertness is still there. So it's not the same as deep sleep.
Oh.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Very deep relaxation. If you want to maintain a little more kind of cognitive awareness,
mm-hmm.
if you want to do that, then there are lots of yogic meditation techniques such as mantra. You just gently
uh-huh.
repeat a
mm-hmm.
word. And all that does is kind of keep your mind just on the edge of being awake. So you're not
mm-hmm.
letting yourself go into that yogic sleep. Mantra is a great technique for just keeping you on that gentle edge.
Mm-hmm. I had tended before to use the Edgar Cayce affirmations,
mm-hmm.
which are very similar to Bible quotes.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you're familiar with Edgar Cayce, but he had worked with a group of women who were interested in developing spiritually.
Mm-hmm.
And so over the years, they had developed two books called Search for God books, which look at the spiritual attributes. So there's a chapter on faith, a chapter on patience, love, forgiveness, etc.
Mm-hmm.
But it all was based, a lot of it was based on meditation.
Mm-hmm.
And so he had affirmations at the beginning of each chapter.
Mm-hmm.
So that if you were working on cooperation, for example, the affirmation was, not my will, but thine, O Lord, be done in me and through me, etc., etc. And so the affirmations tended to focus your mind similar to what the mantras,
mm-hmm.
mantra does.
Yeah, many of the mantras are just like affirmations. They're positive words.
Uh-huh.
And we'll repeat them.
Mm-hmm.
Not only do they bring calmness and steadiness into the mind, but the meaning of the words also adds a lot of positive reassurance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Are there other effects of meditation beyond those that you mentioned earlier?
Well, meditation can also lead to a lot of personal insight into ourselves. As you sit in meditation, you often become more aware of how your own mind functions. And you can see that more objectively. So when you're sitting in meditation, you start to notice more objectively your own mind habits and patterns, and you start to see your own reactions and how you interact with other people, what your kind of thinking patterns are. So there's a lot of clarity about how we present ourselves and how we interact.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then as you sit even longer, you start to have even deeper, I would say, spiritual insight into the essence of your own being as a spiritual being.
Mm-hmm.
And that clarity starts to unfold by itself, sense of yourself as a spiritual being.
Mm-hmm.
And that becomes more present in your conscious mind.
So meditation also is a more holistic approach.
Absolutely. From physical wellness and the health of the metabolism.
Mm-hmm.
Right to our personalities and our social behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
Right to our own understanding of ourselves as a personality, and even deeper into our awareness of spirituality.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah, amazing, amazing.
What is the most effective practice of meditation?
Well, there are many different techniques people use. A lot of people say, oh, well, you know, running is my meditation, or rock climbing is my
mm-hmm.
meditation. I personally find that just simply sitting down on a cushion
mm-hmm.
and sitting still is a practice that may be difficult for people at first.
Mm-hmm.
But then I say, well, sit in a chair then. Just basically sitting down on your seat and being very still
mm-hmm.
is a very powerful practice in itself. You just say, I'll sit here for 20 minutes, you set a time, and close your eyes, relax the body, and bring your attention to your breathing. And a simple thing you can do is watch the breath and then start to count the breath in and out. And you just allow yourself to sit, be still, and watch and count your breathing, and allow some stillness in your daily life. Just 20 minutes of stillness and watching what's going on. Whatever comes up in that 20 minutes is fine. And you just continue to sit in stillness and watch your breathing.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very simple, very powerful practice.
Mm-hmm. What other activities are compatible with meditation?
Well, I would say that activities that improve your health, things like yoga, things like any kind of aerobic activity or sports or anything, all help your meditation because they make you vibrant and strong.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I also think that being selective about your activities, things that don't create more agitation. So if you know that something actually creates a lot more agitation, then that might not help the quality of stillness in your meditation practice. And so
mm-hmm.
to be aware of the effect of different activities on the quality of stillness that you're able to experience.
Mm-hmm.
Yoga is a great supporting practice because it's been designed to help create more stillness.
Mm-hmm.
So it's almost specifically designed to help meditation.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic. I always recommend to people to also get into reading a lot of the books about meditation because
mm-hmm.
I think the mind also needs to be educated.
Mm-hmm.
And the more you can read, the better it will be for your full comprehension of your own meditation.
Do you have any references on your site for meditation?
I have actually, Carl. I've got
mm-hmm.
a reading list on my website
mm-hmm.
there. I've just a few different authors that I've enjoyed.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you read one of the books of one of these authors,
mm-hmm.
then you can go ahead and research more of what that teacher has written.
Would you like to give us your website again?
Oh, thank you. My website is www.padmameditation. That's spelled P-A-D-M-A, Padma, meditation, M-E-D-I-T-A-T-I-O-N, .com, padmameditation.com.
Mm-hmm.
And is it best for people to have an instructor or to work with a group when they're learning meditation?
Oh, yes, I definitely think so. I think that the best thing to do is to get together with an established group that's already meditating
mm-hmm.
and learn with them and sit with them for a while. And you might even try a few different groups to find out which one suits
mm-hmm.
your personality best. And then to be regular, to stick with that and to develop a steady personal practice that you can do then on your own, in your own home, ideally every single day. You do some 20 minutes or 15 minutes of sitting in stillness.
Mm-hmm. One group I found that was very helpful when I started meditating, and that was the Friends Church.
Mm-hmm.
In our area, it's what they call a traditional,
mm-hmm.
but they have services where they sit in silence until the spirit moves them, and then they rise and they speak.
Beautiful.
And so it's a meditation group,
mm-hmm.
and I found that a very good group to meditate with. And then, as I said, the Search for God group was
mm-hmm.
another group that was very good.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have other groups that you would recommend that people might find?
Yeah. There are many different yogic meditation groups around, but again, it's kind of like what's the quality of that particular group of people also.
Mm-hmm.
I also like a Zen meditation group that I sit with often. It's with Norman Fisher. He's out of San Francisco, and he's got a group called Everyday Zen. I believe his website's everydayzen.org. And so they do very good Zen meditation
mm-hmm.
tips and retreats.
Mm-hmm.
I would recommend that. And also, I'm developing a meditation teacher training program, which
right.
I'm
mm-hmm.
just initiating now in Vancouver, but there are plans to take it right across Canada and into the United States. So
oh.
that'll be exciting for me, too.
And then people can also find that on your website?
That one is actually out of a business called Y Yoga. It's yyoga.ca.
Mm-hmm.
And on that website, you can find out about my meditation program
mm-hmm.
and my meditation teacher training programs, actually.
Great. Mm-hmm. Is there anything else you'd like to say about meditation?
Well, I would love to say that meditation is not as difficult or hard as people often think it is.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually a really deeply therapeutic and joyful experience once you get into it.
Mm-hmm.
And just the simplest practice of sitting still every day will have huge and profound effects on the positive quality of your life.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't matter which sect you belong to, whether it's Christian or Zen or yogic, the simplicity of simply sitting and having that quiet time of contemplation and reflection is super healthy for
mm-hmm.
the body and for the mind and for our spirit.
Mm-hmm. Would you like to give us your websites again before we end?
Thank you, Carl. My website is padmameditation.com. That's P-A-D-M-A meditation.com, padmameditation.com.
Great. Thank you, Padma. It's been great having you on the show, and I look forward to having you again.
Well, thank you very, very much, Carl. It's been a pleasure talking to you, and I wish you all the best.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.